It's always good to be together with you to sit and reflect on Torah and our practice. This week we read Vayakal Pekudei, the last two Torah readings in the book of Exodus. At first glance, it seems like these two parshiot are mirror images of the first two Torah readings in this sequence of five Torah readings. So the book of Exodus ends with a sequence of five Torah readings, and they form a bridge between the story of Exodus and the book of Vayikra or Leviticus, which we begin next week. Exodus tells the story of our liberation from Mitzrayim and takes us to the experience of revelation at Mount Sinai. And then it turns to the details of how to build the traveling ark, the Mishkan, as we journey through the wilderness. In these first two parshiot, we learn that we are able to hear God instructing Moses on how to build the building, how to make all its accessories and furnishings. And then so that's in Torah readings 1 and 2 of this series of five. And in the last two parshiot, number 4 and 5, we learn about how these instructions are carried out by the artisans. And in the middle, in the third Torah reading, the one in between the first two and the last two that seem like mirror images about building the Mishkan, is the great catastrophe of the golden calf. So these five parshiot bring us to the book of Vayikra, where we see instructions for exactly what the priests are to do in and around the Mishkan that's just been built. It's also called the book of Leviticus, where it gives instructions for all the rituals that the priests must perform to make sure that the life-sustaining connection between the people and Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh is renewed, because of the inevitable ruptures that happen in our relationship with the source of all life. And these need to be repaired over and over. And we have a series of rituals that the priests do to keep repairing that relationship so we can stay in connection with Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. As Rabbi Alan Liu points out in his book, Be Still and Get Going, the tabernacle, the traveling Mishkan, is arranged in intricate concentric patterning around a charged emptiness at the center. In the center is the Holy of Holies, the empty space into which Moses entered to have direct access to God. And later, this is where the high priest will enter only once a year on Yom Kippur. It's the Avodah service that we read every year during the high holidays. And this pattern, Rabbi Liu points out, is repeated in the literary construction of the five Torah readings that make up the second half of the book of Exodus. The first matching the last, the second matching the second to the last, and in the middle is the essence, the essential message in that charged emptiness, which is the vacuum that was left when Moses disappeared up the mountain and took too long to get back. This is the vacuum into which the golden calf leapt from the fire. This literary structure, Rabbi Liu tells us, is called a chiasmus after the Greek word meaning X-shaped or crisscross. And it's used often, this literary construction, in the Bible as well as in poetry to lead us into and out of a space that contains the essence. And if you look at his book, Be Still and Get Going, he gives several literary examples. So even as the first and the last two parshiot of this series of five seem to mirror each other, I was struck this year by an essential difference. In this center, in Parshat Ki Tisav. The vacuum of Moses' absence is about to be filled by the ecstatic worship of the golden calf and the catastrophic suffering that followed. But right before that happens, when Moses is still receiving instructions for God, God reveals to Moses that an artist will lead us in a redemptive art project to recover from the sin of the golden calf. Right before God alerts Moses to the catastrophe, like, you better get down there because see what's happening down there. Right before that, God speaks to Moses and says, see, I have singled out by name Bezalel. I have endowed him with a divine spirit of skill, ability, and knowledge in every kind of craft, these three things, b'chokhmah, u'tunah, u'vda'at, to make designs, cut stones, carve wood, to work in every kind of craft. And then God instructs Moses in the necessity of rest from work, which grows in significance throughout the generations to come, for all the types of work that go into building the Mishkan are exactly the types of work forbidden on Shabbat. So we see here that God has this plan for regulating the energy that the people will put into building the Mishkan. And it's one of the many contrasts between the golden calf and the Mishkan, because in building the Mishkan, you could see how you could easily get carried away by this urge to keep moving forward and complete the project when you're inspired with this, you know, artistic spirit. But these side rails, as we would say today, that are put on the project contrast to the unrestrained impulsivity of creating the calf, when people ripped off their earrings and necklaces in this desperate effort to avoid their fears about the absence of Moses. They couldn't tolerate that absence, and they just acted impulsively, as we often do when we can't tolerate a feeling. And they made this frenzy attempt to get rid of their fears about not having Moses to lead them, with this delusional hope that their giving their gold could create another permanent leader, or maybe a more permanent leader who wouldn't leave them. Again, in Vayakhel later, there's a similar unrestrained giving. The people are so generous when they bring gifts to the Mishkan, their beautiful crafts, that God had to put restraints on the devotional energy that was in danger of flipping over into this ecstatic, wild practice. And it's described here. All the people poured out their contributions, bringing more and more offerings every morning, until the wise ones who were making all, so the wise ones here who were making all the skilled work for the holy shrine said to Moses, the people are bringing much more than we need for doing the work. So that Yud-Heh commanded for making the Mishkan. So Moses had a call go throughout the camp saying, man and woman, let them not make ready any further work material for contributing to the holy shrine. So the people were stopped from bringing more work, and the skilled workers could then proceed to put the tapestry. So right after that, they start putting the tapestry together in a very specific way, and with very exact measurements that we read that have been given by God. So here we feel that tension, the impulse to pour out one's offerings in an unregulated way, and how it's reined in by God's careful instructions transmitted through Bezalel. We see the impact of that cautious measurement, knowing when it's enough, And that this was brought to the building of the Mishkan by Bezalel and the skilled workers, restraining the forces that had, in their unrestrained energy, led to the building, that led, the golden calf had emerged from that frenzy. So it was not only Bezalel and Aholiab, the master builders, but everyone who brought their creations had some divinely inspired skill. In contrast to the passages in Tetzeva that Sharon described to us a couple of weeks ago, the ones that did not mention the women's contributions, here we read, all the skilled women spun with their own hands and brought what they had spun in blue, purple, and crimson yarns and in fine linen. All the women excelled in that skill of spinning goat's hair. So, Bezalel and the skilled workers were filled with the Spirit of God and were able to create incredible designs just as God had commanded Moses. One might wonder, they've been wandering through the desert for 40 years where they weren't involved in any careful craftsmanship. They weren't building any structures to last permanently. No furnishings. They weren't doing anything to beautify their space. And before that, they were doing heavy labor, not fine crafting in Mitzrayim. So where did these skills come from and how were they developed? A close reading of this narrative shows that God tells Moses the exact instructions for building the Mishkan with all the measurements, like one would find in a blueprint. But there's no account of Moses transmitting this information to Bezalel, nor is there any specific narrative about Bezalel learning the measurements directly from God. Yet all the artists are divinely inspired and endowed with that knowledge, and that seems to be enough to enable them to build a space that will invite the presence of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh into the Holy of Holies. So this mysterious transmission of artistic skills and craftsmanship to all the artisans reflects something that remains essential to the artistic process to this day. Artists often describe the art, the creative process as just coming to them. It came to me, people will say. Songwriters and composers talk of receiving a song or hearing it. Novelists talk about how their characters come to them, speak to them. Writers talk about having to wait for their characters to reveal themselves. Sculptors talk about their work as removing the stone that's hiding the form that's waiting to be revealed. Artistic creation is mysterious, imaginative, and it feels to some divinely inspired. In her book, The Lost Art of Scripture, Karen Armstrong writes beautifully about how Scripture was intended not to be a fixed, lifeless text, but as an invitation to engage in a transformative, creative, artistic expression that makes it possible for us to experience an expanded state of consciousness. She begins the book with the story of a very small ivory figure in the Ulm Museum, which may be the earliest evidence of human religious activity. Lion Man is 40,000 years old. He has a partly human body and the head of a cave lion. Archaeologic evidence indicates that this cave in which it was found was not a place where people lived, but a place that may have been set aside for communal ritual, where people gathered to enact the myths that gave meaning and purpose to their hard and often frightening lives. Lion Man shows that human beings were now able to think of something that does not exist. In other words, this isn't a cave painting that's representative of real animals that they hunt. Lion Man is a product of the imagination. And since then, we've used our imaginations to connect with something beyond ourselves and our day-to-day world, a connection that seems to give meaning and purpose. And this process, it's not just a tradition, it represents a yearning, a longing, a thirst. The word thirst, often used to describe the visceral sensation of seeking spiritual connection, reflects one of the many images and metaphors that represent longing for God across different religions. In our own tradition, as Rabbi Tova Spitzer points out in her book, God is Here, Reimagining the Divine, God is often represented as water. Water that springs forth from the rock in the desert, water that saves the life of Hagar's son when she's despairing that he will die of thirst, water that parts miraculously for the Israelites. And Miriam, the priestess, could find the source of water in the desert. Metaphor is another way that art and the imagination are part of our religious practice and connect us to a sense of belonging to each other and to something beyond. Rabbi Spitzer writes eloquently about this in her book that's been chosen as a TBZ community book read. That's why I read it. And she'll be at TBZ for a book talk, and she'll be interviewed by Rav Claudia, I believe. On March 18th, next week. So I will wrap up with another metaphor from her book, which reflects one of the many images of God. No, actually, her book reflects on many different images of God. Like there's a metaphor for everyone. In other words, God as fire, as water, as rock, as place. Metaphors that may, as wind, as spirit, ruach, metaphors that may more closely reflect our sense of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh than the metaphor of king or leader or all-powerful parent. Earth, all these metaphors. She notes that Hamakom, the place, is one of the names of God. And we see repeated references to Hamakom, particularly in the story of Jacob. So this is the scary night when he's fled from his home, setting out for the first time all alone to escape his brother's revenge for stealing his birthright and stealing his older brother's blessing. And in this description in Genesis, we find the Hebrew word Hamakom is repeated three times in the first few verses and three times in the last few verses. What do you know? It's a chiasmus because we have these verses going preceding the dream. Jacob encountered the place, Hamakom. He took one of the stones of the place, Hamakom. He lay down in that place, Hamakom. Then, in the next verses, we read about the famous dream of the angels going up and down the ladder from this place. And Jacob awakes from his sleep and says, "Surely God is present in this place, and I did not know it. Yesh Adonai b'makom hazeh." How awesome is this place? And he called the place Beit El, House of God. He recognized that God was right there in this place. And as we read the Torah as an invitation for participation an enactment, we are reminded that God is in this place right now, wherever we are. Even in moments of despair, if we can expand our awareness, just as Hagar looked up and saw the spring of water that had always been there, we may see how God is in this place. Jacob sets up a stone, another metaphor for God, or a spiritual practice. And the early inhabitants of the British Isles set up Stonehenge, and many other people have set up markers, marking the place as being a portal for connection. And so the wandering Jews built a Mishkan in the wilderness, which represents God as a makom, the space where we come together to connect with God. And as Rabbi Lu pointed out, it's built as a series of concentric layers through which one passes. Before reaching the Holy of Holies at the center. And this, of course, can be a metaphor for our relationship with the source of creation. What are the layers that keep us from connecting with that charged center? Is it the layers of busyness that keep our minds narrowly focused on what's the next thing we have to do, so that we have to get through those layers in order to enter into a more spacious awareness? The layers of thought that preoccupy us so that our minds are not free to be open and receptive. The masks we feel we need to wear to protect us from direct connection with another who might hurt or reject us. Or our busy work days each week with the emptiness of Shabbat at the center. So theoretically, we could find that powerful, charged emptiness at the center of any moment or any place, but because we're human and because we're nourished by relationships with each other, it helps to step into an actual place, and particularly one that has a beautiful aroma with Torahs that hold our sacred teaching, where we sing the words and prayers, where we see the Ner Tamid that Sharon talked about 2 weeks ago, the candle that's never extinguished. And because we are human, it also helps to sit down in a quiet place, preferably with each other as we have now, and allow the breath to soften and open the layers that keep us from experiencing that charged emptiness that's within each of us.